Get started?
Yeah, let's get started.
Great. So the spirit of these talks, I've been told it's 5 slides, so I have, last time it was 2 slides and 10 plots, so I literally have 5 plots. And I'm actually quite excited to give this talk. So this is not on ultra-faint galaxies. This is a project that I worked, this is looking at SDSS galaxies and doing sort of statistical studies with dwarf galaxies. This is something that Mike Blanton and I published a few papers using the SDSS DR4, looking at very low luminosity dwarfs in 2005 and 2006. And Mike has now gone through DR8 and, as I'll explain, reconstructed the nearby sample so that it's a clean sample of dwarf galaxies. And so we're just starting to do science with this kind of awesome sample. So the caveat is there's a lot of science to do that has not yet been done. This is the first science paper on the dwarf galaxies, and so we've just decided to focus on sort of one science question, and there's a lot more questions. So, you know, there's a lot I won't be able to answer. And I've just finished up the draft on this particular topic, and so if, you know, you have questions or comments or whatever, I'm really interested in getting feedback. Okay, so the bottom line for this first paper is that there are no quenched dwarf galaxies in the field. And I promise to define every single word in that sentence.
With the rest of the hour.
I know, absolutely, not a problem. But just a little bit of context. So many different papers have looked at the frequency of quenched galaxies, a fraction of quenched galaxies as a function of blah, of whatever. And most of these have been in SDSS. And so this is one particular paper that I know well. This is Andrew Wetzel, who's a postdoc at Yale, looking at the quenched fractions of galaxies, be them satellites or central galaxies, in SDSS as a function here of stellar mass. And so the colored lines are various different satellite galaxies and different mass halos. And the line to focus on here is the dashed line, which they've selected central galaxies, so the central galaxy in some dark matter halo. This is a group catalog. At a stellar mass of 10 to the 11, the quenched fractions, that is galaxies that are not forming stars, is basically 100%. As you go down in stellar mass, these become the quenched fractions become lower and lower, and down to something like a little bit below 10 to the 10, the quenched fraction is something like 20%. The reason they can't go below this is because SDSS has issues below 10 to the 10 in the nearby universe. So let me explain what these issues are and how we solve them, where we is Mike Blanton and not me. So if you go into the public catalog in the Sloan survey right now and you ask for a dwarf galaxy that has an absolute magnitude of minus 15 or minus 16, you will often get something that looks like this, that looks quite nice. You can get a mass, you can get a velocity, it's all really fabulous, except if you look at sort of the greater area, it's a little bit shredded bit of a large galaxy. So the SDSS photometric pipeline was designed for higher redshift galaxies. Things that are nearby and extended tend to get shredded up and torn into pieces. Occasionally there'll be fibers put on these things, and so it's kind of a mess. And so Mike has gone through and extracted everything, in the nearby universe. This is called the NSA, and it's called the NSA, which is kind of an unfortunate word to put in your emails. So the NASA Sloan catalog. So this is a re-reduction of all of DR8 out for galaxies or for spectroscopic sources that are out to a redshift of 0.055. So this is local universe out to like 200 megaparsecs. He's also folded in a lot of nearby data on big, massive galaxies. So everything in the RCS2, Alfalfa, basically everything from UV to near infrared and H1 that's out to 0.055. So this is available online, although I just went into the website and it's down right now, so that's the way things go. In terms of dwarf galaxies, this is now a clean sample, so we can go to this catalog and ask for dwarf galaxies. And so in the stellar mass range now between 10 to the 7 and 10 to the 9, so 10 to the 9 is stellar mass is an LMC, 10 to the 8 in stellar mass is an SMC. We have now pretty large samples. So there's about 9,000 galaxies between 10 to the 7, 10 to the 9. Most of those are obviously at 10 to the 9 and just a few at 10 to the 7. Of these, and I will define this word, about 3,000 of these we will define as being in the field that is relatively isolated. And in the field, and I'll motivate this sentence in the next slide, we choose things in the field that are 1,000 kilometers, that are within 1,000 kilometers of a big, massive galaxy no, what is that? That are farther away than 0.15 megaparsecs of a massive galaxy and farther than 100 kilometers a second. We also define quenched galaxies as having spectroscopic properties that are quenched. So an H-alpha in the SESS fiber that's less than 2 angstroms. And we also use this D4000, the 4000 angstrom break, which is an indicator of older stellar ages. And we use a criteria that's basically, greater than 1.6, which is consistent with these things being red, but it's sort of a one step beyond just being red.
I have a curiosity, what's the sort of lower redshift limit here? Because if you say you've got to get about 200, is it like 50 and 200 or just kind of?
So this is not one of my 5 slides. this is the sample. So absolute magnitude versus redshift, those are observed properties, and then computed properties are stellar mass versus distance. So we don't look right close in. I think the cutoff is 10 megaparsecs just because there isn't a whole lot of volume there. And the arbitrary outer limit is this 0.055 in redshift.
Why is there suddenly a lot more stuff like right at 0.2?
It's just a volume thing.
No, but it looks much more subtle than that.
Nope. I think it's just the points. I agree with you, but it's not real. So we're cutting things on stellar mass, and so the red things are all of these quenched galaxies. And so this is, you know, kind of something that's buried under the hood most of the time. But you know, for a given stellar mass, the object, you know, an object is less luminous for a given stellar mass. And so for a given stellar mass, if you ask how far in volume I can find an object, it's smaller for a quenched galaxy than it is for a star-forming galaxy. And so we correct for this using 1 over Vmax corrections. We don't do a volume-limited sample. We do 1 over Vmax corrections, which might be a little bit distasteful, except that if we tried to do a volume-limited sample, we really couldn't do this work. The numbers wouldn't be high enough. So. So for each, when we do like these quenched fractions, we weight each point by the volume in which you could have found it. And this is just for completeness. So this is this D4000, the 4000 angstrom break. You know, the blue cloud and the red cloud, you can see it still in this diagnostic. And there is some tilt to it in the same way that there's some tilt to the G minus R color cut.
Why are you plotting higher stellar masses on the left, Marla?
Oh.
To be consistent with magnitude.
Okay. That's great. That's feedback.
Yeah.
Fun. Awesome. Okay. All right, so now we can do things with this sample. This is the property. So if you cut this sample into 2 stellar mass bins, so things that I would consider sort of more massive, 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10, and the next mass bin, 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9, this is sort of the properties, just to give you a feeling of where these things lie. So as a function of the distance from a host galaxy, so this is if you find a massive galaxy, within 1,000 kilometers a second, you ask how far away it is. This is that sort of a parameterization of the environment. As a function of G minus R color, H alpha index, and 4,000 angstrom break. So what's interesting is that what's interesting is if you look at these things that have very low H alpha, so basically zero H alpha emission, in the higher mass bin, you can see points that are out here at 1, 2, 3, 5 megaparsecs from a massive object. And here, there's one object there that's really going to drive me crazy. But there are basically no things that have very little H alpha.
Any of these properties, these galaxies dwarfs, right? I mean, are just an extension of this general distribution. I mean, I don't see their distinct population.
Absolutely not. They're not a distinct population. So, you know, let me get to the next plot, and we can sort of talk about there. I mean, it's a continuum. So now let me plot the red or the quenched fractions as a function of this environment parameterization for a bunch of different stellar masses. Okay, so this is for a fairly high stellar mass, larger than the LMC. The red fractions right in very close to a more massive neighbor are fairly high, 30%, and then they decline to a flat value, but that flat value is non-zero, something like 5% for stellar mass 10 to the, 9.7? As you step down in stellar mass, the same behavior that it's higher and closer to something, but this flattening off is at a lower value. And then for the lowest stellar mass spin, so 10, below 10 to the 9, as you get out basically beyond 1 megaparsec, this becomes flat and essentially zero.
What is the host mass there?
Right, so host mass is greater than 10 to the 10 stellar mass.
That 1 megaparsec is larger than you would expect
the real radius. It is larger than the real. It's about 3 viral radius.
Right.
And that's scientific, that's interesting.
So sorry, is the stellar mass, when you say it's larger than 10 to the 10, is that with a small spread around you?
It's anything that's larger than, so basically, we look, our host sample is galaxies that have absolute magnitude of, I think it's minus 19.5 or more massive. That's our host sample. Then we match that to the dwarf sample.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering what sort of range and host mass that you have.
Whatever is in the local volume. Yeah.
Can you define it in terms of magnitude, in terms of stellar mass?
It is it's defined in terms of magnitude, yeah. So this is within, so it's 1,000 kilometers a second, which is very, very large. And then there are objects that are out, we search out to 7 megaparsecs, and if we can't find a match, we set it at 7. So I actually don't go out as far as we look.
Did a Sloan Get spectra of all of the possible host galaxies?
For the most amount, yes. For all the host things, there are. So it's not just Sloan. This is combined with RCS2 and every, all the local things as well. Okay. So at this point, I am going to define field as a dwarf galaxy that's beyond 1.25 megaparsecs, just to kind of be well beyond this sort of this transition here, and call those things field galaxies, and then ask what the quench fractions are there.
So what is interesting is that even on small radii, the majority is not quenched.
Yeah.
Only 30%.
Yeah, it is interesting. So, I mean, this is not true in the Milky Way, or it is true in the Milky Way in this here, because if you took the LMC and the SMC, our quench fraction actually wouldn't be all that low. But if you went to the M31, the quench fraction would basically be zero.
This is a projected.
Yeah, so we haven't dealt with projection. It's not as big. It's not a big deal as you'd think. So yeah, this is slightly inflated, but it's a few percent. It's not like by half.
I mean, very lovely in 3D, if you would go to 1 megaparsec,
then
everything is.
No.
A lot of satellites are
not. Yeah. So the Milky Way is weird. It's not weird, but at least down to SMC, it is actually.
So if you decouple these, but they're assuming you have a circle distribution.
Yeah.
How far would these numbers go up or down? Fractions. I mean, so if
you so the central fractions would go down slightly, like 5 or 10%, but it's not a factor of 2.
I mean, you're taking a lot of stuff long line of sight into account here, so then further away, so you must go up.
That's not an explanation.
No, I'm just asking what the level of the issue is.
It's small.
No, but it cannot go down. Must go up. From a projected value, if this declines as function of projected, I presume it declines as function of 3D, and therefore, right, and you have more contamination along the line of sight in a cylinder.
Ah, you're right. So this could go up slightly. You're right. Yeah.
So, according to your definition of quench fraction, what would be the equivalent in a cluster? Say, if you were to make the same plot for Virgo or Coma, would the fraction go up to 80-90%, or would it be?
So, that's a good question. I do not differentiate with hosts and with like really, really dense environments. And in fact, I don't want to deal with that right now. But presumably, if you go to Virgo, it's basically 100% right in the center.
The definition is such that
it depends. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We know that it's very weak dependent. So there's the first order of function of stellar mass, and not so much of the host halo to which you belong. Or
it's just the satellite stellar mass.
But it is true, right? If you just draw a line around Virgo, all of the dwarf galaxies are quenched within the central regions of Virgo.
I mean, that's clusters. I'm not so sure.
Well, it depends.
I don't think.
What's quenched exactly?
Not forming stars.
That's something like
H alpha.
H alpha is zero.
Yeah.
That's
so I am then this is a choice. I am only focusing on the things in isolation for this. And so there's a lot of stuff to do with, you know, and that's stuff that Frank has done.
You're saying, I don't agree with that. I don't think it's true. I mean, we cannot talk down those stellar masses at 9.75, but we can look. I mean, if you look at Jeremy's work and our work, these factors do not go to one.
Well, maybe by the central part of Virgo, how central is.
Well, yeah, it's a good question.
We look at the function of heliocentric radius, okay, and you don't see very weak
error. 10%, I'm sure. Yeah. It's got to be much
more. It's not much higher than what it is at the outskirts.
Right.
Yeah.
Like what data?
I just look at a lot of similar to this, the angles and the integral, but they agree that it's perfectly.
How close to the center do you get? Can you quantify your completeness?
How close to the center of what?
Of the host galaxies.
It's not so much detecting them, I assume, as getting stars.
Yeah, I mean, 100 kiloparsecs is more than an arc minute at 50 megaparsecs. So it's not, we aren't missing lots of things. But again, maybe at, you know, within 0.1 here, yeah, we probably are missing certain things.
I mean, yeah, I think it's good that you're.
Again, I'm not worried. I don't really care about the centrals at this point. I'm much more concerned about the things that are in isolation.
In terms of equipment working each other, what does it mean in terms of specific information, right? Can you translate that for us?
Yeah. So you, it's like minus 11 for specific star formation rate, but that's not exactly the right. You can't translate precisely.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have star formation rates taking the, you know, H alpha flux is a fiber and the object is extended, and so we use the U band galaxy when we have it, and so I have the star formation rates, and it's like 0.02 solar masses per year, sort of the average for the quenched objects and below.
And so there's no trend in specific formation rate across mass of the satellites. Like, it's not that you're looking at things that are more or less quenched with the solar mass. Like, if you had a fixed line luminosity, we would have that.
But they're all at different distances, and so, I mean, it's going to be a distance-dependent limit on what the star formation rate is.
So this looks like it's a very strong function of stone mass.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the next plot. okay, so this was the Wetzel stuff. So now, in order to compare, you know, sort of the apples to apples, we've taken the same group catalog, taken those galaxies, applied our definition of quenched. And so here they only use specific star formation rate, less than minus 11. Here we're using this 8 alpha cut and the 4,000 angstrom break. So at the very most massive object, because we have an 8 alpha cut, we're cutting out things that are AGNs and that sort of thing. So they're not exactly. The fractions between these two are not the same, but at least we'll be consistent within our own framework. And so here are the points for the DR8 SDSS catalog, where in this overlap region, we're actually overlapping with exactly the same galaxy. So the blue points are DR4 group catalog that is volume limited. And the red points are DR8, not volume limited, Vmax corrected. But in the region where we overlap, the same galaxies are quenched. The fractions are slightly lower for ours because its definition of field galaxy is slightly more conservative than for central galaxies. So we understand why they don't match perfectly.
What do you mean by our beer group?
Where do I write that? Ah, yeah. So here, the when we define central, we're looking in the group catalogs, we've defined central as going out to 3 Vera radius instead of 1 or 2. Okay, so what you see is that the red fractions can, or the quenched fractions continue to decline. And then below 2 times 10 to the 9, we have one, and this is one object out of 3,500 whatever that passes this definition of quenched. So in other words, quenched galaxies are extremely rare in the field. And with this one object, which is this point right there, it's 0.02% of the population is quenched below 2 times 10 to the 9. Stellar mass. So that is an interesting limit.
So physically, what can account for such a sharp drop over like a factor of 2 of stellar mass? Like at 10 to 10, you're at 20%, and at 5 times 10 to the 9, you're at 0.
Why do you care about that one? Why don't you care about the fact that there is a continuation already at 10 to 11?
Yeah.
So So something shuts off central gas. Yeah. Some people claim it's agent-free breakdown.
It is about the same mass scale that you start seeing in ecological transition, and where you start seeing galaxies with evidence of having levels.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Let me skip that plot. I started to look at AGN fraction this morning or last night. It didn't work out really well. but this is interesting. Looking at line ratio. So this is Lisa Cooley's definition of AGN. So this is O3 to H beta, N2 to H1, H alpha. So star formation things are on this side, AGN-ish things are on that side. If I do the same, you know, fraction of things that pass this versus don't pass this and plot it as stellar mass, it doesn't look very good. But
it looks great.
I have to look at this a lot more, so I don't quite understand the numbers, whether I've done all the right cuts in terms of errors.
Exactly right.
It does, but except that, so it's interesting because this is instead of 2 × 10^9, this is a, you know, 6 or 7 × 10^9. So there's the cutoff, and that might just be where you draw the AGN line if you draw a little bit more conservative.
It's also important
So I don't understand AGN very well at all. Yeah, so I would love to talk to someone about doing this a lot more subtly. But this is a sort of thing that we can do with this sample.
But it seems pretty high. What do you percent?
Yeah, so I have not looked in the literature about what are the AGN percent.
20% is absolutely.
But if you 3 × 10^10 solar mass, right? It's almost approaching.
No, I think it's
exactly
at that mass.
let's see. So going back, so if we only have quenched fraction, quenched galaxies in the field, you can go back and look at where the quenched galaxies do in fact live. And so for the quenched galaxies that are in the sample below 10^9, asking what is the fraction of viral radius of the host galaxy away from where the object lives. So for each object, I just look at what its host is and what the viral radius is and plot it as a function of that. So 90% of the galaxies that we have quenched, 90% of the quenched galaxies are within 2 viral radius.
Are they estimating the
viral radius? So this is using Risa's Baruzzi et al. So based on the stellar mass of the host, and then converting that into the viral radius. And this is this, you know.
You're using viral radius of the halo mass of the Tinkerbell group catalog.
We could. It was easier for me to calculate it directly from the stellar mass of our hosts, but those should be the same numbers. Sure. So I could do the same thing over. It was just easier to do it this way. We don't have. So the host galaxies aren't in the Tinker et al. Catalog for these objects necessarily, because these are closer in. So it's a volume-limited catalog. So this probably it is possible that all of our hosts are not in the Tinker et al. Catalog.
So why did you use, I mean, since you can derive the virial in whatever way you do it, virial radius, why didn't you make the cut? I mean, you made a physical cut.
Why didn't I do it based on virial radius?
Because, radius
yeah, I agree with that. This is the way we started. So I could go back and redo the whole thing based on virial radius.
Is that one quenched object? Maybe it's not in the field because of this one.
It's that guy. It's at 4.5. We could go through and do this the opposite way and do it based on viral radius. Actually, it wouldn't take that much work. We could do that for sure.
But it's been tried that at all, viral radii, I guess. Because the way the systematics work, it's better to go for a movement sort of to a dark matter halo rather than the other way.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good.
So what about the one quenched galaxy?
Yeah.
Have you looked at it?
Yeah.
Is there like a star point?
Is it VHL 1.9?
No, yeah, it's kind of on the line. It's not close enough to the line that I can kick it out. It's interesting. I don't know what to do with it.
Should you look at the image and see that?
Yeah, it looks red.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, it looks red. It looks nice.
No, but is there another galaxy?
Is there anything outside the
fiber?
Come on!
I know.
It's out
of 5,000. You know, it's like out of 3,500 objects. It's a huge number. So I haven't looked for a dwarf-dwarf pair. We were just talking about this morning. So I could look and see if there's something nearby that's way below our host mass that's making this thing red. Absolutely, and that's we were looking through. And there are a lot of dwarf-dwarf pairs in this particular catalog, which is interesting as well.
How long do you have to shut star formation off in a typical galaxy like this to turn it
into
your definition?
It's about a half a giga year. So the H alpha cut is only, you know, it's mega years, but the 4,000 angstrom break takes a little bit longer. So another issue that we were concerned about, but I'm pretty sure is okay, is surface brightness issues. Right. So the SDSS has a really severe surface brightness cutoff at about 24 magnitudes per square arc second for the half light radius. But the key here is not that we're missing low surface brightness things; it's that we're not preferentially missing quenched low surface brightness things. So if I look at in the denser regions, if I look at the distribution of surface brightness for quenched things versus blue things, those distributions are consistent with each other. So therefore, if I go to the field, I should not be missing, preferentially be missing low surface brightness quenched objects unless there's a population of quenched things below, you know, the SDSS surface brightness. It would have to be a weird population in the field. So there, I'm not concerned about low surface brightness issues, which people have brought up quite a bit in this sort of stuff. So those are my five plots. I can show other stuff, but I'm not allowed to go past five theoretically.
We could just go through the same slides.
We can go through them again? Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, things that we want to do next, so that if there are no quenched galaxies in the field below 10 to the 9, we want to look at the star-forming ones. That means that, you know, 3,499 objects are star-forming in the field, and those things are also very interesting. And so Mike Blanton is writing up the blue paper, and I'm doing the red paper. We have gas masses for many of those. So for about 10% of the isolated star-forming population, we have gas fractions, and we have H1 masses, therefore we have dynamical masses. And so we're going to redo looking at the baryonic Tully Fisher, looking at baryon fractions and that sort of thing. And we've been talking about that some earlier today, so I wanted to take a look at, here is for this particular sample, the gas fraction. So for things that we have gas, which is a slightly inhomogeneous sample, this is including stuff we've done with GBT and Arecibo, as well as some of the alfalfa, or I think all of the alfalfa stuff that lands within the SDSS footprint. So gas fractions, again, as this environment parameter, and then as a function of stellar mass, the gas fraction as well.
You've got some low gas fractions. Oh, those, that's for
but yeah, so yeah, this is for everything. Okay. So all of our low gas fractions are within sort of 2 megaparsecs. There's a couple, maybe there's 3 or 4 objects that we should look at in a little bit more detail.
The star forming galaxies.
These are whatever is fell into the alfalfa footprint. Yeah. So this is only like 10% of the sample I was showing before. So all the things that have low gas fractions are within sort of you know, a megaparsec factor too.
Well,
yeah, so I haven't color-coded which are which.
10 to the 8 things that have really low gas fractions, but it looks like those are all quite close in.
Yeah.
So that's consistent.
Yeah. So, you know, as we've kind of talked about before, the gas fractions for the lower mass things, you know, continue to go up. And so there are a lot of things that have gas fractions that are up at sort of 90% or larger.
Have you looked at this, the host gas fraction conditional on stellar mass? It's amazing that you don't see any trans with D holes, right? You don't see
I would say that there's this part of the diagram is there are no things in this part of the diagram.
Yeah, but it's small. But what I'm interested in is if you go to zero, right? We see that suddenly there,
yes,
infection starts to shoot up.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing quenching the field, which means something environmental is quenching, and it's probably something to do with gas removal. So why do we see, if I get very small D holes,
but the majority is still gas rich?
So if something is gas poor, I can't see it. So we need to. I don't think you can just sit and look at that plot and say something.
Well, but it should be a transition, right? You don't go from 99% gas fraction to zero overnight.
I agree. I would want to do that a little bit more carefully, though. But I, you know,
I think one thing you want to do first is do a conditional instead of mass, because
I agree with you. I plotted this morning. You know, another thing to look at is we can now do the baryon fractions as a function of whatever you want as well. We have the stars, we have the gas, and we have the H1 width, which is, we call a dynamical mass.
So if this is removed by baryon fraction splitting, you probably want to do it also in terms of mass of the host.
Well, he just said that doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, I would like to see.
Well, so it would be interesting, that would be interesting to see if it doesn't.
A statement about carbon dioxide mass.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you fall into something like very, very different than if you fall into the.
Agreed. So if you don't see a trend, that's really interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting.
The funny thing is that if you look at satellites above them, the 9-7 masses, there is a remarkably little dependence on what the mass flows. And so here, it would be very interesting to see.
So in your sort of, like you talk about points to not points, but you have equivalent widths of an NHL of all of them except the positive ones, so nothing.
Well, we have equivalent widths there as well.
Sorry?
We have equivalent widths for everything. I mean, you can measure an equivalent width if you have a spectrum.
It can be
zero or negative, but.
But then, do you see any trend as function of radius from the distance from the host? Do you see that it sort of continuously declines and gets to when you hit?
No, it's a little bit case by case. Is that for the other thing, right?
No. No, we have not.
It's a burst before they shut off, so in that case you would see capers, A features.
Yeah, but you expect some sort of effect, right? I mean, towards this sort of 1.25 that you say is speed will come. So, I mean,
basically, this is, you could somehow tease it out of that plot. I don't know if you can do that visually. But that's the information that you want.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But you would expect some sort of trend.
So I think, you know, looking at this transition zone is really interesting. And how to do that, I think, is subtle, but that's something that this sample can answer. Yeah?
Some people in the high-resolution community have been looking a lot at what other galaxy properties seem to correlate the best with being quenched.
Mm-hmm.
And they're finding that stellar mass actually is not sort of the best variable following your x-axis. It seems that velocity dispersion or Sursuch N.
So we can do Sursuch, and I've looked at that, although it wasn't really definitive. We don't have dispersions. For the ones that are over 100 kilometers a second. Oh, for the H ones we do. Yeah. Sorry, I missed that. What did
Frank was saying that Whittaker had claimed that surface density was the determining factor, and I was saying that seems to be correct.
Got it.
At least for, these people working with high resolution samples.
We've done for the, a long time ago now, we've done the baryonic Tully Fisher, that's what we were discussing this morning, that's sort of close to what you're talking about. But we don't have, we have it for a small number of objects. So I was looking at the Tully Fisher, and I was trying to understand these numbers, and I wish Stacy was here so we could argue a little bit.
You're consistent with everyone.
That's probably
what's
right.
I know. this is from DR4. We had something like 100 of these isolated objects with H1. I take that back. These are not all isolated, but we didn't see any trend with where those things lie on the Tully Fisher and environment, which is kind of interesting. But we certainly do see a larger scatter as we go down to lower masses. Sorry. So this is all the colored stuff is from the literature. Many of those colored points are in Stacy stuff.
So there's your own analysis, determination of stellar masses.
I cannot remember. And then the black are the stuff from DR4. In this paper, Stacy doesn't choose to plot those points.
That he doesn't trust these widths based on H1.
Based on H1.
Well, the line base, like you said, he did not try.
Okay, so these are all based on optical
rotation
curves?
Rotation curves.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
That automatically increases your scatter.
What?
He did have a reason for leaving them.
Okay. To do this in large numbers, it's got to be H1 because optical rotation curves take a really long time. We actually do have unpublished rotation curves for maybe 30 of those things, and that's my unpublished Magellan data.
That's about 30, that's about as many points as I can see there.
Yeah. The H1 and the optical rotation curves kind of match, although I personally trust the H1 more because I think they go out to larger radius. And on average, those velocities are larger, and so I think that they're going out. We have no idea how far the H1 is going.
You mean the alignment, or the rotation goes in H1?
Okay, so where we have an optical rotation curve and an H1 single dish measurement, the H1 single dish measurements tend to be larger, which I interpret as going out to larger distances, but I cannot prove that. Right, and so none of those optical rotation curves turn over.
Right.
They all kind of, you know, peter out well before they, you know, there's a hint of a turnover maybe, but it's all imagination. So
he's a finite, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So we now have a whole lot more points that we can put on that plot, and that's just something that on the to-do list. So it will be interesting to look again as a function of, you know, isolation and all those things, and see whether or not, you know, I would assume that if you took out the things that were in more dense environments, the scatter would go down. But I don't. That was not true for that sample.
Have you compared the H alpha equivalent widths with the gas fractions to see if maybe there's anything that is not star forming but is gas rich?
No, that's a good idea.
That's very interesting.
Can you remind me afterwards?
Just
yeah, that's true, actually. No, we haven't. So Mike has been doing a lot of stuff with the star-forming objects, and I don't actually know where his analysis is at the moment, but I haven't really looked at what the star-forming things are doing. So it's interesting. I mean, there's a huge range of H-alpha equivalent widths. And so one thing we were thinking about is looking at the things that have the highest H-alpha equivalent widths, so the most crazy star formation, and sort of see what is going on in those objects. There's also a sample, so we've gone through and weeded out all the things that look like they're mergers, but we see a whole lot of dwarf looking mergers, you know, things that are destroyed but are pretty small. And so that's another sample to go after and do follow-up to look at sort of small merger systems. But that's all, again, on the to-do list.
So you could just as easily define your field sample as being within a certain distance of anything, right? Not just a big galaxy.
So the worry then is then, you know, incompleteness and that sort of thing. It's a smaller and smaller volume as you go down to lower and lower things that you want to define environment as. So yeah, we certainly could do that. Which is the equivalent of asking, you know, of redoing the group catalog down to -16 or down to, you know, a much lower stellar mass.
Can you say anything on the structural properties of the isolated?
Yes, what would you like to know? In the catalog, it's SDSS. So it's, you know, Mike fits a smooth Sirsic model to it, so we can get A and B and sort of the residual out of that. Beyond that, we can't say, and we can go in and do the analysis over again, but in the catalog to do quickly, no.
So, we're fossils.
Yeah, so they're not. We don't go down to low enough stellar mass. So what we, I mean, so if they're fossils, right, that plot stays at zero for a little while, and down over here has to go back up again.
Right.
Can I reference you?
Yeah.
So what mass does it go back up at?
I think that's
6.
Five, that
would be 6. Oh, okay, really low.
Right, and so 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 right now in the Milky Way, we can...
Of the, those guys are still isolated.
That is an unknown.
But it's something you can look at it, right? So
yeah.
You can look at all the dark matter and the fresh...
You can't look at it observationally.
But it's actually good. So, but we can, if we have predictions, we can then go and do it. So the reason it's hard observationally is because, you know, it's a huge investment. You have to survey and you have to, but if we knew that there were going to be, you know, 500 dwarf fossils per, you know, whatever, we'd go down and look that deep, right?
But those, yeah, so I mean, those stellar masses, you're only going to be looking sort of in the local group region.
Oh, so if we go down to 29th magnitude with HST, we can do it, you know, over, let's say, an arc minute.
Yeah,
I know. So then if we have hard predictions for the number of those objects, then we can motivate a larger, slightly larger server. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, you can go to 26th magnitude over a very wide field if you want.
For 0.6, for the...
Yes.
Well, so then that's the question. So we can do point sources down to, you know, out to maybe a megaparsec, and then they start becoming unresolved. Then it becomes harder. But, you know, if we're using, let's say, HST, you can go out to 20 maybe like 10 or pretty far megaparsecs to do individual stars, and then you can figure out what that overdensity is and know how far out you need to survey.
But having it be resolved is okay as long as you have a good object detection algorithm. And that would be the tricky part, but in principle, it's possible.
Which is why I'm totally excited about the superconducting CCD thing. Yeah, that actually solves this problem, right? So the issue.
20 years ago, when I am still in.
You want to have a lab tour? We can do that this week.
MKX is not the same technology as the word that is 20 years
ago. This is how big is it, this city?
It's not a city, and I don't make them.
It's all too
at the moment, no, they're kilometers. At the moment, they are 32 by 32, but they can be scaled up.
32 what? Oh, things.
It'll still be a while, I think.
Well, so there's a, no, he was writing, there's a proposal to the Keck SSC for megapixels, and that was a proposal, so that was, a couple of years off kind of thing.
So they're easily scalable because, so you shouldn't ask the issue, that's bad, but what happens is that you just feed them with a single cable, all pixel. So you don't have to have wires attached to every pixel like you had for old energy sensitive detectors. So the main problem in scaling up is the result because you don't need a comparable which coming through.
And so the thing that he said is that you can get down to like 26 magnitude with quickly. And so then if you have the star galaxy issue, if you have, an R of 30 spectrum from UV out to the infrared, you can do star galaxy separation instantly. And then we can do, then we can search for ultra faints out to as far as we want, or as far as 26 magnitude goes. So I was really excited about that. It was the first time I actually thought this might be feasible.
How much in terms of money? $3 million.
I mean, it's feasible
in 3 years.
Going from 1,000 to 1,000,000 in 3 years. I mean, so I know nothing about the technology beyond what you've said, but that seems.
But I think this saves. I mean, this basically saves. This saves LSST in some sense, right? You can now do very fast follow-up and do star galaxy separation really quickly, and I think. No, it doesn't save it, but it does. It makes it makes the mileage a lot longer because you can actually get spectra down to 26.
Okay. 3 years.
Great.
All right. So can we put that
Venmo
on the coffee?
So if I'm thinking of this in terms of a stellar mass fraction as a function of halo mass, then this goes completely the opposite way as you want it to go. Right? So the high halos actually have a lot of star forming, have a very high bunch fraction, so it's compressed, and then it goes down, and then it jumps back up again.
Is what I want.
No, I don't think so. Like you have the crunch fraction in sort of where the peak is of M star or M halo is very high.
Mm-hmm.
So the star formation efficiency is higher in higher mass halos?
So I guess what I'm saying is like in these very, where the points are red, stuff is forming lots of stars. But that's below, quench fraction is zero.
So the star formation rates in these things are low.
Okay, but it has to be per halo mass. I guess that's maybe what I'm trying to get at. They are still quenched, but not, quenched isn't the right word, but their star formation rates are low.
Yeah, so these things are inefficiently forming stars and inefficiently.
But I guess maybe I'm confused.
Yeah, I mean, how much does that depend on how you define star formation efficiency? Because if it's a specific star formation rate, then that's probably still increasing, but it's relative to the gas mass.
So if you look at for the ones we do have gas masses, if you look at the gas conception rate, I mean, it's Hubble times down here.
Quenches
makes you think water's
been thrown on a fire or something.
Yes. That word does make me think of that, but in terms of.
I think it's just run out of fuel.
Yeah, so it's not that it's run out of fuel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe passive would be better.
Passive. I like passive better.
It's aggressive, and then it's.
The aggressive galaxies. Yeah, I'm
Yeah.
No questions?